Radio EcoShock.
Hi, I'm Alex. We're going to go right back to Britain to talk with Dr. David Wasdell as he explains that we shouldn't take just climate heating as a sign of climate change. There's a lot more to it. And we'll go into his other views on the possibility of extreme climate change hitting us and hitting us soon. As I take it, the first burst of heating, let's say, gets soaked up into these various sinks and processes, whether it's melting ice or warming the oceans. That could take a while, but eventually when those break, then we may see a lot of more heating on the land.
Well, we're already seeing some heating on the land that is quite detectable. And in certain areas, because a lot of the heat energy gets pushed towards the poles, for instance, the temperature over Greenland and around that area was about 4 or 5 degrees above what it is expected to be this last year. We had heat anomalies over northern Canada and into Alaska. We had heat anomalies over northern Russia and Siberia. And so the big land masses are showing heating of 3-4 degrees in their polar areas, even though the average temperature increase for the Earth as a whole is only 0.8 of a degree. The critical thing to focus on is that the energy going into heating the Earth and changing the climate is inexorably going on, whatever the temperature is doing at the moment. So don't let people tell you temperature change is slowing down. There's no problem left. The problem is going on, whatever the temperature is doing.
Let's move to a second fundamental point that you make clear. There are a number of forces called positive feedbacks which multiply the impact of our human-made greenhouse gas emissions. Can you tell us how this works and why it matters so much? And please.
When I started work on this just over 5 years ago, we recognized that the effect of what we call feedbacks was, if you like, the greatest known unknown that we were struggling with. And the impact of that determined really what was going to be faced as the crisis for the future decades. My background is in what we call systems analysis, not necessarily in climate change, but we shifted application to this area and began looking at feedback processes. I think most of you who are listening to this will have been in a public hall or situation where the PA system has been turned up too sensitive and you know, it's gone into that scream, and you go, you put your hands over your ears, oh no, and where's the technician? Go and turn that thing down a bit. That's feedback, where the signal that comes out of the loudspeakers, the output stuff, gets picked up on the input side of the microphones and fed back through the amplifier and out through the loudspeakers and into the microphone and out through the amplifier and builds up until it reaches a feedback threshold and very uncomfortable. Well, the climate system is like that, except that there's about 40 identified feedback mechanisms in global climate. What we have done is put out a signal, if you like, that's our greenhouse gases and the heating that stems from that. That begins to change things at a planetary level. Temperature starts to rise a little bit. As the temperature goes up, the water vapor in the atmosphere increases. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. That increases the greenhouse effect, which changes the rate of heating, which pushes the temperature up more, which evaporates more water, which increases the greenhouse effect. You got the idea? And there are many such feedback mechanisms that I could go into. For instance, we know now quite well that the amount of sea ice in the Arctic area is decreasing in summer, year by year. It went down to an extraordinary low in 2007. 2010 was just about the same record level. And on a trend pattern over decades, it is decreasing quite rapidly. Now, that's an effect of heating. But what it does, it decreases the amount of white surface in that area of the world during the summer period. So we have dark, open water, which absorbs sunlight and sun's energy and heat and warms up. And that increases, therefore, the absorption of energy in the Earth system. It decreases the reflectivity of the planet. And that means that the amount of heating goes up, which of course melts more ice, which means there's more open water, so the heating goes up. And that's another, what we call an albedo positive feedback. Have a look at the Teilberg presentation, which I think you're giving a link to on your website as a result of this interview.
Yes, indeed.
I do go into quite a lot of detail about feedbacks in that.
Well, one thing I got from that was that these feedbacks may well pile up on each other so that if we think, well, we'll just double our fossil emissions into the atmosphere, we may in fact find that natural reaction to that could multiply it not by a factor of 2, but by a factor of 4 or more. Is that correct?
Yes, and we get into areas of huge uncertainty, but about the precise quantities, because we've never been there before. But the process is pretty clear. Let me give you another for instance then. One of the issues that we look at is that the great tropical forests like the Amazon rainforest, at some stage in this development of higher temperatures and drying out of that area, begins to break down and change from tropical forest into savanna. Now, that's a difficult process. That's tree death, it's burn, it's forest fires going out of control across vast areas. That's a huge, huge release of carbon dioxide from the burning and the degrade of a huge forest area. And that adds to our human emissions from the use of fossil energy and increases the rate of global heating. The same, I think, you're experiencing in Canada with the spread of the bark beetle through the coniferous forests moving up towards the tundra. And as the temperature warms, the larvae of the bark beetle are not dying out over winter. And that is racing through your coniferous forests like the plague. And those trees then start to die back. There is burn back, there is decay. And we get the northern forests going through a carbon output as well. That adds into the problem. Now, you may want to ask me more about the tundra release and what we call the methane release. Would that be interesting?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with David Wastel, director of the Meridian Program in England. His lecture series, Beyond the Tipping Point, has rippled already through the expert world. Now it's going mainstream. We should talk, I think, about the methane briefly, and then I'd like to get on to your idea of tipping points.
Okay, let's try and take this briefly. In the far north of the major continents, that's northern Canada and Alaska, and in northern Russia into Siberia, there are vast areas of frozen land, the tundra with permafrost. And as the temperature goes up and the heating to the earth focuses, much of that energy is transported to these areas faster than at any other place in the world. And that means that these areas of permafrost are beginning to melt in the summer and melt further each summer. And one of the consequences of that is that microbial activity begins to rot the frozen vegetation that's been held in the cold store, and that starts to release carbon dioxide. And another byproduct of that is methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And there are deposits of methane held deeply frozen in the tundra, which begin to be released. We're seeing that happening already. There are lakes developing on the surface of the tundra with methane bubbling up, and you can actually catch it and set fire to it. There's about 3 times as much carbon stored in the tundra deposits as we have already put up from burning fossil fuel. So as that goes, there's a huge cauldron or deposit, potentially, of further carbon dioxide and methane, which could be released into the atmosphere and is already starting to do so. And then the really big one is that under some of the shallow seas, there are vast deposits of methane in a frozen crystal lattice form that we call clathrates or methane hydrates. And they're held in place under the temperature of the ocean depth and the pressure of the ocean depth and the temperature at which they are. And they're protected as well with ice over that surface of the ocean in many places. Now, the ice melts, the water warms. There is warmer runoff from the northern coastlines of the continental areas. The sea starts to warm, the sea mixes down to the bed, and it starts to release methane bubbling up from the seabed. It starts to break through the fossil ice that has stayed there since the last ice age, that is trapping fossil deposits of methane even deeper in, and those are beginning to come up through the rotting and permeable frozen layers of the ocean bed. And scientists are watching this very carefully because that is a feedback. Because the methane is released into the atmosphere, that increases the greenhouse effect, that increases the temperature, that increases the heating, that mixes down to the ocean floor, that sets off more methane, that releases. You get the idea? And that is potentially the biggest but long-term feedback that can push the temperature almost out of control. Very worrying.
Yes.
But you're talking about tipping points.
Yes, well, you know, James Hansen has said there's many tipping points, but you have said there may be a kind of master tipping point, a point that if we cross it, the result will be catastrophic climate change. What do you mean by that?
I'm glad you raised that question because there's quite a lot of misunderstanding about tipping points. Let me give you one or two quick examples. I've already mentioned the tipping point in the Amazon rainforest between an established forested area and tipping across into the development of a savanna area with a huge shift. That's a threshold point at which, as the temperature globally reaches a certain level, a particular factor, like the sustainability of the tropical forest, shifts into a new behavior. And once you've passed that threshold, there's pretty well nothing you can do to stop that shift happening. It can be quite dramatic and fast. Another one would be the melting of the Greenland ice cap. Now, we're already seeing significant ice loss of about 300 cubic kilometers per annum net release of ice from Greenland. And I've got a feeling I may have got a zero wrong there. It could be more than that. But let's just take it on the principle. As the temperature increases, we reach a point where the Greenland ice cap itself begins to be non-sustainable. It starts surface melt. Water goes down to the base of the ice. That lubricates it. It starts to move down to the glacier valleys. It discharges to the sea. It melts in the ocean. And once that process starts, it feeds on itself because there is then more fresh water in the ocean. There is greater feedback around the edges of that ice cap. The level of ice starts to go down. The further it goes down, the warmer it gets because it's warmer at lower altitudes. So it melts faster. And you move into this new zone of not just a sustainable ice cap, but a collapsing ice cap. That's a tipping point. And John Schellenhuber and Jim Hansen's been involved, and Tim Lenton and many other scientists have pinned about 9 of these critical tipping points, like the Gulf Stream that brings so much energy across the Atlantic to Western Europe. If that starts to falter, and there are conditions that make it do so, that would be a tipping point, because Northern Europe will then become much colder, but the Gulf area will become much hotter. And remember, that's where all the tropical storms and the hurricanes get their energy from and lash into the east coast of the States. Those are what I call subsystem tipping points. They're thresholds at which particular phenomenon change from one state to another. Now, if you look at the Earth as a whole, it looks very clear now that there is a critical threshold, a tipping point, if you will, between a state of the Earth in response to climate change that just goes up fairly slowly and reaches a new, hotter level, an equilibrium, as they call it. And the threshold is between behavior that reaches an equilibrium, it may be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees hotter than it is now, and that's catastrophic. But if this threshold is crossed, then it moves not to a new equilibrium, but to a self-amplifying runaway behavior. And where that stops at the moment is anybody's guess. But it is a whole new ballgame of looking at the future climate. In my Tailberg lecture, I specify the criteria for that. I look at the implications of it. And I make some assertions about what I saw then as the fact that we had crossed that threshold and had already started on the pathway of runaway behavior. And I'm very thankful that there was a mistake in that analysis, and we found it and put it right. The threshold was not as close as we thought it was, and we probably have not yet crossed it. But it's there as a threat in the future, and the processes that we have already put in motion make it look to me as if we are in a fairly severe risk of triggering the runaway behavior in the Earth system and crossing that total global tipping point. We don't want to go there. We have to be able to intervene early enough to make certain that that does not happen.
Perhaps that's a good point for me to ask about the possibility of any happy ending. I don't see a good outcome for our big surge in fossil fuels, but you did offer one last vision of hope. Can you share that with us?
You know, people always look for hope when faced by something that feels impossible to cope with, don't they? Whether it's illness or whatever it is. And I think there's realistic hope and there's illusory hope. And there's despair. Despair can be realistic despair. Despair can also be illusory. What I don't see at the moment is any hope at all of the global political and economic and intergovernmental negotiating decision-making process, achieving an action intervention that can solve the problem in the time frame required with any realistic outcome of a survivable planet for humanity as we know it. And I have to live with that reality. I don't think it's despair. I don't think it's gloom and doom. I think it is the reality we face. Secondly, the sensitivity of the Earth system, how it amplifies the signal we have put in, the CO2 we've emitted, has been grossly underestimated in current science. That underestimate underlies all the targets being set in Cancun or not being set in Cancun. It looks as though there's an error of about 2.5 times the effect of the dynamics of climate change. It's far worse than we thought it was going to be. I think that's reality. And that, again, is not to be despaired at, but it creates a sense of eco-shock that is profound. Now, hope. At the end of my Telberg presentation, I used the image of the shift from a supertanker to a shoal. And if, do you remember that? You saw that presentation, I think.
I do. And for listeners, by a shoal, you're talking about like a shoal of fish, for example.
A shoal of fish, that's right.
Yeah.
It's so dynamic and it moves almost incredibly synchronously through the water, particularly when it's under threat. But if you think Copenhagen and the economic processes, the political processes, are like some massive supertanker that is hugely inert, controlled by a tiny power elite, fueled, if you like, by fossil energy and the profits from it, and is going absolutely in the opposite direction with enormous inertia and power. But those institutions are put there by human beings, little decisions from millions and millions of people over time. We construct the supertanker. And I think the time is coming to deconstruct the supertanker, for each and every one of us to take personal responsibility, institutional responsibility, whatever our area of responsibility is. It may be individual, it's a home, it's a local community, it's a small organization, and we can work together in such a way that we take on board the reality of the crisis and develop what we call a phase change in human behavior that shifts from the command and control failures to a living, learning, moving system of humanity responding in a crisis in short time scales and at a level that actually makes a huge difference. That, I think, is a sign of hope in the social process. And I think we need to be paying much, much more attention to that as a way forward as we face the despair of the criticality of the reality we face and the failure of our political institutions to deal with it.
So there may still be the possibility of a mass shift among the people rather than in their upper institutions. We could still hope that like those fish or the birds that you see in the sky that suddenly know it's time to turn one way and head another, that could still happen for us here on Earth.
I think that's probably the only realistic hope we face, Alex.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up?
Yeah, I think I could bring you a story. I like stories. Do you remember the Apollo space program?
Yes.
I'm sure you do, and Apollo 11 and the landing on the moon. I think half the world was glued to the television when that first small step for humanity was taken. Big one for humankind. That was Apollo 11. Do you remember Apollo 13, two launches later?
Vaguely.
Okay, and Tom Hanks did a reconstructed movie on this one, which other people will have seen. Apollo 13 was launched and went off very smoothly, running by the book, and then there was this catastrophic explosion in one of the oxygen tanks, and it blew off half of the coating of the module and so on. And we had that laconic comment, you know, Houston, we have a problem. And the Houston Command Center went into, I don't think that's possible. It must be a computer glitch. And for 15 minutes, they treated it as nothing in space had happened. They were just trying to solve the computer problems back up. And then all the signals began to come in from the monitors to say, actually, we've just pretty well lost the propulsion systems, the life support systems on this module. It really is a catastrophe. Well, we've taken 15 years to not recognize that planet Earth, we have a problem. We've blown a hole in our life support system. And I think what happened on Apollo 13, if you like, is a parable for our time. They had to abort the mission, the achievements, the goals, the wishes, the hopes, if you like, of going around the moon and doing another moon landing and all that. And they shifted the mission, like that switch in the path of a crowd of birds or a swarm of bees or a shoal of fish. and they started to move in a different direction. Survival was the agenda. Close down power systems. Find ways of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere of the module. Find ways of supporting each other with the food and the water that they needed for the long return journey. Keep each other alive if they possibly could, so they didn't lose anybody on the way back. Not knowing whether there was damage to the heat shield, whether they could in fact achieve a re-entry, even if they got it right. Loss of correction and computer systems, having to do a manual course direction just before re-entry. And they made it. Now, I think Apollo 13 is a parable for the planet. It's no longer a tiny module out in space. We are the module. Planet Earth, we have a problem. There's no Houston. There's no rescue. We are also Houston. So maybe humanity, in the spirit of response to a collective crisis, can mobilize a collective response that puts survival, not exploitation of each other, to protect our own personal interests or national interests or group interests and let the weak go to the wall, but a collective survival movement that solves the problem in the time frame we have. I offer you Apollo 13 as a parable for tomorrow's world.
And there you have it. He has presented the awful facts and fears of climate science to major conferences across the world. David Wastel is the international coordinator of the Meridian Program and director of the Apollo Gaia Project. You can find out more about that at apollo-gaia.org. All the links you might need for this are in my Radio EcoShock show blog for this week at ecoshock.info, including a recording of that Thalberg speech. Listen and learn, please. David, it has been an honor to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure.
We've just heard an in-depth interview with David Wasdell. You may object that David is not a full-blown climate scientist. True, but he is certainly plugged into climate science and highly regarded by some of the world's best. I'm going to give you a load of links from the best climate science so you can check Wasdell's claims for yourself. Here is just one cross-check. At an international climate conference called 4 Degrees and Beyond, held at Oxford, UK, Dr. Richard Betts, a climate modeler from the government-funded Hadley Centre, delivered a speech which backs up most of the points you just heard made by David Wasdell in our interview. You can download that speech by Richard Betts and others from that key presentation with a link from our show blog at ecoshock.info. These talks were the basis of the recent released papers by the Royal Society. I'll quickly summarize a little from the Betts presentation. He explains that our current greenhouse gas emissions are at the high range of projections made by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in their 2007 report. As the West refuses to cut emissions, nothing going on in North America, as we've heard, and as Asia joins the fossil-powered civilization, we are headed for the worst predictions. The most widely studied IPCC projection for medium emissions takes us to 4 degrees Celsius of average global warming by 2090. Most scientists consider that disaster. Even higher variations suggested by our current emission path were not studied deeply at all, being considered too extreme to happen. Since 2007, however, the UK Hadley Centre, among others, began to look at what would happen if we failed to control our pollution of the sky. First of all, understand that an average global warming of 4 degrees centigrade will not be evenly distributed around the world. Some places, especially the Arctic, will get much, much hotter, perhaps 6 or 7 degrees C warmer within this century. Precipitation, Richard Betts explains, will also change greatly. The Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Amazon will dry out. The high Arctic will become much wetter. Scientists are looking on more exact regional predictions. Even these models, Betts says, do not account for feedbacks or interacting feedbacks. At 16 minutes into the talk, he makes David Wasdell's point exactly. In particular, the carbon cycle, the way carbon moves from the sky into both the soil and the sea, is projected to stop working in the same way in a rapidly warming world. The soil, which holds far more carbon than the atmosphere, may become a net source of carbon instead of a sink or collector, as it currently is. And a drying Amazon would release gigatons of carbon as trees die or burn. Richard Betts says when these feedbacks are taken into account, we may reach 4 degrees centigrade of warming by 2070 or even 2060. That is 7 degrees Fahrenheit as a global average. Places like the southern United States would be unbearably hot for over 100 days a year. The summer sea ice in the Arctic would be a distant memory. Italy and Spain would be more like Saudi Arabia in heat and dryness. Agriculture would be severely damaged in a world expected to hit 9 billion people at that time. Tropical diseases spread north. Many species can't adapt and go extinct. A mass extinction, you get the picture. It's a disaster. As Wasdell said, until recently, scientists didn't study this terrible scenario because they naively assumed world governments would act to stop the wanton pollution of the atmosphere. Now there are at least 149 computer models running in various labs and on the net, struggling to catch up to the climate race. We can add the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, to that list. After previous conservative climate estimates, this year MIT doubled its projected heating to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, 5.2 degrees C, mean global warming by 2095. That paper was peer-reviewed and published in the American Meteorological Society Journal of Climate. You need to subscribe to view that, but in my blog, I've linked to Joe Rome's summary of that terrible news. And once again, as David Wasdell is warning us, even this bad estimate does not include the positive feedback loops operating in the Earth system. MIT study author Ronald Prin says, and I'm quoting here from Joe Rome and Prin, "And the odds indicated by this modeling may actually understate the problem because the model does not fully incorporate other positive feedbacks that can occur. For example, if increased temperatures caused a large-scale melting of permafrost in Arctic regions and subsequent release of large quantities of methane, a very potent greenhouse gas, including that feedback is just going to make it worse," Prin says, end quote. Scientists haven't included feedbacks, and the piggybacking of one feedback on another, as David Wasdell was describing, because they just don't know how to model it yet. The Earth system is so complex, it is essentially unpredictable. But we know it can happen. It is already happening. None of the governments at Cancun Climate Conference know this. It is not in the 2007 IPCC report. The media can't communicate this story properly. Even you and I, slogging through these developments, can barely comprehend what this means. All we know is we don't know enough, but our current emissions are leading us to a climate disaster within this century, within the lifetimes of our younger listeners and our offspring. In a rare step, the Royal Academy has decided that the prospect of 4-degree warming is so important that, for a few days, they released the entire contents of their new theme issue on 4 degrees and beyond warming, and they let it out to the public. Now it's back behind a pay-per-view firewall. In the spirit of WikiLeaks and the need to tell the people what we face, I've uploaded all those papers as PDF files to our website. Make it your project. Read it for yourself. Find those links in my blog as well at ecoshock.info. Look for the title, Beyond the Tipping Point. I've also posted a paper by David Wasdell called Runaway Climate Change, Boundary Conditions and Implications for Policy, an interim report dated November 2010. So you can see the graphs and charts that should accompany our Radio EcoShock interview and his speech in Tallberg, Sweden. Get the audio from that key David Wasdell lecture, Beyond the Tipping Point, from the Climate 2010 page at ecoshock.org as a free MP3 download. Lots for you to do and learn, with all the links at ecoshock.info for this program titled Beyond the Tipping Point in December 2010. And why not? Only the future of the world is at stake. Is that worth your time and effort to know? I hope so. Each one of us needs to be like Johnny Appleseed, distributing this critical information as far and as fast as we can to avoid climate catastrophe. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for your time and for your commitment.